there are a lot of religious groups that are interested in becoming involved in social transactions as we are. And it was very interesting being in Zimbabwe this last 6 weeks, because as an avowed socialist country, it has a lot of resources which are not available to us here in the West. We located 4 or 5 really interesting bookstores, one of which is called the Grassroots Bookstore, as a matter of fact. We didn't tell them about the October 20th message, but one of the first sets of books I picked up was called Training for Transformation, a handbook for community workers. And it's two women who are in a Christian organization who have worked up these 3 workbooks. And on the back it says, Training for Transformation provides a basic and comprehensive text for adult education workers, social workers, community development workers, church workers, and trade union educators, and all concerned with the process of transforming society. I think that includes us, too. they said Training for Transformation integrates the approach of Paulo Freire and how to put this method into practice. And he was one of the great educators who has worked long and hard, particularly in the Latin American countries, and dealt a lot with how to raise the consciousness of people and how to get them involved in activity. Group methods which are essential for participatory education. Organizational development which stresses how to build structures which enable people to become self-reliant. And social analysis to help groups find the root causes of their problems. Now, they go through 3 volumes of little tips and techniques. A comprehensive theory runs through these 3 books on how you work out the problems and approach these problems and get people involved. And I'll just tell you the first few steps that they're suggesting, and then you can kind of take it from there and figure out what they're doing. First of all, I have a basic assumption that they present that there's 2 different kinds of approaches as far as education is concerned, and this goes along with the work of Paulo Freire. He says there are 2 different kinds of approach in education. One is the banking approach. That's where the student sits right here and the teacher fills his head like he's filling a gas station. Actually, that's what we're doing with you tonight, but unfortunately, I like to take the other approach, but we don't have the time. This afternoon, we did the other approach. Okay, the banking approach, the teacher is seen as possessing all the essential information. The pupils are seen as empty vessels needing to be filled with knowledge. The teacher talks, the pupils absorb passively. Now, the other kind approach to education is the problem-posing approach, where the animator provides a framework for thinking, creative, active participants to consider a common problem and find the solutions. The animator raises questions, why, how, and who. The participants are active, describing, analyzing, suggesting, deciding, and planning. And boy, we would certainly like to have Baha'i communities like that when we go out to teach, when whether we're pioneers, whether we're here in local communities or whatever. We'd like to see this kind of thing go on. Now, they give some examples of how to begin to get people involved in the discussions. And they gave a very interesting example of how they would present 2 skits to the community and begin a discussion of different methods of approaching problems in the community. And in one skit, they have a community development officer going out and standing in the front of the room and kind of directing the conversation and not listening to the people's responses very much, but obviously he has his own preconceived ideas of what community development is going to happen, and he's just there kind of to enlist their support and actually direct their support at the end. The second skit is, of course, a much more participatory kind of community development officer who goes out, encourages people to talk, and one of them suggests a football field and the other suggests a clinic, and they come to some conclusion, and actually 3 people in the group want the football field, and one person goes along with that, so they decide to have that. Now, one of the authors says, actually, this set of skits came from a real-life experience that she had. This exercise was developed from a real-life experience in Uganda in 1959. A village had numerous problems in both the health field, all types of worms, malaria, bilharzia, no clinics, and a very poor school from which the teachers were nearly always absent. In a village meeting, the people really did insist that their top priority was to make a football field. I was appalled, but the CDO, the community development officer, very wisely encouraged the group to go ahead. They made their football field, started playing football, organized a team, played matches against other villages. The football field was a turning point in the life of the village. They had gained self-confidence, a structure for communicating with one another, and a sense that they were capable of changing things. Later, they tackled many other more important projects. But were they really more important? Was not their own intuition that they needed something that would build their own sense of themselves as a community and their confidence that they could achieve their own goals far more important than my outsider priority that they needed a clinic? This was also a turning point in my own education about how to work with communities. Later, I heard many other stories of how football fields had helped deal with serious problems of teenage drinking. So we can go on and on, and this book has a lot of illustrations, lots of suggestions for going through the different kinds of steps to get people involved in action planning. They suggest very strongly the use of codes, that is, some sort of audiovisual material or some sort of skit to get people involved in talking about their problems. And they'll present, let's say it's a picture of someone who's a woman who's poor and doesn't have some sort of resources that she wants to have. And they'll get the group talking about this, and then they'll say, now, is this a real-life kind of situation, after they determine what it is that's going on in the code? Is this a real-life situation here? Are there any problems like this here? Now, very soon they'll find out if there are, if this is a real problem in that area or if it's not a real problem. And also continue the conversation and the discussion and find out what related problems there are and what are the root causes of these problems. And then move on to the action planning and the evaluation of this. Now, this is very different from the community development officer coming out and saying, you have a problem with worms, you know, you better all go to the clinic. It's a very different kind of approach. One of the approaches that a doctor, David Werner, lists in Where There Is No Doctor, he calls his method of involvement the "but why" method. The child has a septic foot, but why? Because she stepped on a thorn, but why? Because she has no shoes, but why has she no shoes? Because her father cannot afford to buy her any. And it's so on and so forth, so that you begin to get people to think about what are the underlying causes behind whatever problems that they happen to be tackling in their community. So first we have some sort of descriptive material that's presented or somehow given to the group, an analysis of what this is, a determination of whether these kinds of things are problems in real life in their community or not, and what are some of the related problems, and some of the root causes and action planning. Now, of course, you can realize very readily and very quickly that this can lead into social revolution. And that's what a lot of this kind of social action planning does lead to. I mean, that's what it was intended to lead to, overthrow of governments and things like that, which obviously we don't want to get into. So we have to stop before we overthrow the government and try to work some other way than that. That's a terrific series. Any Baha'i could get loads and loads of ideas from that series of development transformation. There are even problems about how to deal with family problems in the community and how to consult, how to build confidence in the groups that are coming together to discuss these kinds of problems, and just lots of wonderful tips for Baha'is. Now, this other series that I picked out is called Learn and Teach. This comes from South Africa. It has to do with literacy, and that's its main aim, because it has the words in large type that helps people learn to read. But it, as Paulo Freire said, teaching an adult to read is not the same as teaching a child to read. You don't start in the same way and you don't proceed in the same way. You begin much more when you teach an adult to read to teach them things that are very meaningful and that will keep them really interested in learning to read. So first of all, here's an article about electricity. And an area was electrified, and how to read your electricity meter, how much you can estimate that it may cost you, so that you'll know how much electricity will add to your total bill, or how many hours you can keep on a light before it adds more money to your total bill. So these are learning kinds of things that people can use in their everyday life. There's an article about working with a drill for the road and some of the problems, health problems that men face when they're working with these drills in the road, and what health signs to look out for and what to do if these things occur. There's an article about unrest in schools and how kids are receiving unfair punishment by teachers in the schools in South Africa. They must love this in South Africa. And here's a poster for kids to hang up in their school called Punishment, Your Rights at School. And it goes through and tells them exactly how they can be punished at school and how they can't, and what line the teacher can't step over, so that kids will know what their rights are at school and actually suggest to them to post it at school. For instance, the headmaster cannot hit the student more than 4 times in 1 day. Oh, and that's true. The headmaster must not use a stick, must use a stick not longer than 75 centimeters and not thicker than 1.2 centimeters. What's the law in Swaziland then? Got one there? About the same. Okay. Now, there are articles about Lesotho and the people who are waiting for jobs there in Lesotho. And the last section has to do with sending money by post, learning how to use postal orders, what they look like, where to fill in what, and money orders, what to expect, how to fill it in again, and then registered mail. It's all geared for sending money through mail, which there's a lot of in Southern Africa because there's so much migrant labor in and out to South Africa and back again. And it ends up with some cartoons, some fun cartoons, and fun things to read, too. Okay, that's a series published in South Africa, but widely used all over Southern Africa. Now, we were talking about women's problems this morning, and here's a book that's published in Zimbabwe by a women's group, and they're going to have a whole series of these kinds of things. They've got about, let's see, there's about 20 chapters in here. And the topics they cover are things that they want to speak to women about and have them begin to think about and see what they can do about to change their lives. Housework, childcare, water, wood, money, food prices, farming, selling, education, work, women's place in society, etc., etc. And their basic technique is to present some sort of small skit and then get the women talking with some guide questions about this. And then they have some ideas in the back, in the appendix, about what women can do, what services they can use in the government, and who they can go to or what they could do to change this situation. Now, here's one here. The woman asks her husband if she can get a part-time job on the cotton farm. He refuses. He says a woman's job is to look after her family, her home, and her fields, as Zimbabwean women have always done. He is against these modern cheeky women who want to do things away from home. He says he is earning enough for the family, and she must continue to look after the family and her fields. Okay, so then here are some discussion questions. What did you see happening in this play? Why did he allow his wife to work? Are there some women in your area refuse permission to work or do things outside the home? What does your tradition say about a woman's place in society? Is this tradition still acceptable to modern women in the 1980s? Is it fair for men to refuse their wives the chance to work? How can we together help women to do more things outside of the home? In the back, in some of the guidelines, I don't know what it says for this chapter, but it says we can change tradition by bringing up our children differently. As a group approaching the organizations our husbands belong to that preach equality, we may have people approaching the Baha'i faith saying, talk to these husbands. Or by changing laws, e.g., in Portugal, there is a law which says that husband and wife are both free to work or join groups without the permission of the other. Here's another example in this. Here's a thing about widows. I won't read the whole story, but the woman's, all of her possessions are being taken away by her husband's family because she is not considered able to hold property. And so as soon as her husband has died, her husband's family has come in, taken all the possessions, and she's left destitute. And then they talk about some questions to discuss, and they talk about inheritance laws of a customary marriage or of a civil and church marriage to educate the person. And then they also suggest in the back on chapter 15 to learn about the new laws, and that also that your group can organize a campaign to get your husband to make a will so that you will be left the property and it will be stated in the legal will. So they're, in other words, they're beginning to talk to women, get them to think about these things, because very often, and as an anthropologist, going out into places, why, when we approach women about these things, they'd say, we never think about these things, or we never think about what we can do, because this is a tradition and a custom, and we don't know how to change these kinds of things. There hasn't been a lot of confidence that's been built into a lot of the women, and so they feel kind of helpless about changing all of these kinds of conditions. This is a kind of book that will give them more confidence in learning that they can deal step by step with these problems, even, you see, if it's just in educating their children for the next generation, which is a real important kind of thing. That, you know, change may not come instantaneously. They may not find their husbands changing completely by next week, but at least they know that they can make a difference in the next generation. A little booklet on family financial planning and managing money wisely, couched in very simple terms, but which groups could take and study. Quite a thick book on nutrition for developing countries, but with lots of ideas about how to present this to people with felt posters and different kinds of demonstrations about nutrition, about the various merits of breastfeeding, and the problems with bottle feeding and the expense of bottle feeding and non-sterilization, so that people become very involved in learning something about nutritional standards. There are groups like Moral Rearmament. I don't know if you know Moral Rearmament in the United States. They're all over the world, but they're already into Zimbabwe and Africa. Which Way Zimbabwe? There's a little booklet, the same one called Which Way Africa, in which they talk about what's Zimbabwe's future, and that we want to be careful now that we've thrown off the colonial yoke, that we don't get involved into some of the same vices of materialism and sex and some of the problems which led groups astray. And then here are the four standards that they put up for the new age: absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, absolute love. And lots of cute illustrations, and it's a very inexpensive book, which people are buying in these bookstores. Moral Rearmament, MRA, yeah. Moral Rearmament. It's all over the world. I think it's world headquarters is in Switzerland, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know. No, they have centers all over. On a little bit different kind of level, there's a journal called Social Change and Development, which speaks to probably a more literate audience about different kinds of problems, and each issue is devoted to a different topic: education, health, the economy, and whatever. This was an interesting article here: tourism, the road to development, ? A lot of times countries will want to build up their tourist industry, but this one points out the pros and cons of the tourist industry. What are the tourists going to want? Imported French wine, cheese from another country. Where's our money going to be really going? Who's going to come and build the hotel, Holiday Inns, and the money's all going to go to America, and so on and so forth. There's a couple of cute cartoons down here. One is 1903 with these Victorian-type missionaries coming to the Africans, and they say, cover up. And here, 1983, the Africans are all now very fully dressed, standing in front of their house, and they're saying to the tourists, cover up. uh, I wish I could go on and talk about this. This is a new booklet published by the counselors in Africa called A New Kind of People. And it draws together a lot of quotations about the distinctive characteristics of Baha'i community life and some laws concerning Baha'is, some Baha'i characteristics, living the Baha'i life, and our role in the Baha'i community. It's a wonderful set of quotations, and somebody can really have a field day taking this and bringing it down to the level of community involvement, like these books right here, so that people could really understand the application to their own life individually, rather than just having the set of quotations. Because, as you know, it takes, you know, some thought and study for each one of us to try to get a quotation and grasp what the idea is, the nugget is, and then how we can apply it to our own life. And the more we can kind of have workshops and groups like this and discuss what does this mean in our own life, why, the faster we'll be able to catch some of the ideas and begin to apply that. So this would be a wonderful compilation for someone to take and to work into a development booklet similar to the ones I've been showing you. Since Betty talked about women and development this morning, I'm not going to talk about that because there's not just enough time left. I'm going to skip and go on to a few of the development projects that we noticed when we were in Africa. When I was at the Auxiliary Board Conference, the Auxiliary Board members were asked to tell about some of the things that were happening in their countries. And so these are a few of the things that they mentioned. In Bophuthatswana, a Baha'i center was built, and they put in the borehole or the well very close to a nearby village, so this village could also have use of this water. So they did this as a community project, thinking about the village and the fact that water is very scarce there, and often people have to walk long distances for water each day, and they felt that they could provide this service to the village. Also, for those of you who know the map, Bophuthatswana is divided into lots of little scattered pieces, and at this point in time, the South African government is trying to buy up some of the intervening land, which belongs to white South African farmers, so that they can turn it over to Bophuthatswana and unify seven of its larger pieces. And at this point, they may have a lot of very inexpensive or free and or free land, which the Baha'is have their eye on and would like to get to establish a farm, which will help support the Baha'i funds and some of the new social and economic development projects that they have in mind. So we'll keep our fingers crossed, say a few prayers for the Baha'is in Bophuthatswana that they get some of this land that's going to be bought up in the next few months. And Malawi already has this kind of farm, some sort of agricultural farm, and I think it grows mostly vegetables, and it adds a lot to the Baha'i funds in Malawi. It's all done by Malawian believers. Zambia has been trying to hold institutes to help people in their training in agriculture and to learn about self-help schemes, cooperatives, and they now have four tutorial schools going also to help students out in the rural area. Swaziland now has three nursery schools or preschools started. These are started on a commercial basis so that the students, the small students that come, pay a certain amount each month, so they are self-supporting schools. But there are not very many of these preschools in Swaziland at this point, and so these are some of the first ones that have been started. They're also training local teachers to work in these schools. In Zimbabwe, of course, we know that there's been a lot of drought areas in Africa this last year. In Zimbabwe, during the drought, the government appealed for private groups and church groups to give some sort of aid, some relief to the people who were starving or hungry in the rural areas. And the response of the Baha'is was to collect quite a lot of money and buy the sacks of maize meal or mealy meal and present them to the Minister of Rural Development. And when they did this, the whole thing was televised. It was done on television, and the Baha'is were pointed out as responding to the government's call. Actually, at the same time, one of the other churches presented a check which was for a larger amount than the Baha'is. But the Baha'is looked so impressive because they had all the bags of maize meal stacked right there. You know, it's much more impressive to have big truckloads of maize meal stacked up in sacks than it is to have a small paper check presented to you. And so the Baha'is got quite a lot of publicity out of that. Another thing that's really been called for in many African countries is the planting of trees, because there weren't very good conservation methods used all during the colonial period, and a lot of the areas have been very denuded of trees. This has resulted in a lot of erosion. It's also resulted in lack of firewood and shade and a lot of the things that trees can provide. So the Zimbabwean Baha'is have had tree planting projects, and this last, I believe it was last December, they had quite a large tree planting project where they went to different schools and planted trees. They also have now a little mobile unit, a little trailer that they're going to use for audiovisual materials to take around out in the rural area. But they also envisage this as something that they can use to help teach about health and sanitation and other kinds of social and economic development lessons, too, at the same time. And indeed, they have had institutes for women. They have a lovely new institute about 20 minutes or so outside of Harare. An old home, which was actually, I shouldn't say old, but it was started by someone else and then sold. It's kind of almost a Moorish looking mansion, or Spanish looking mansion, with nice big white arches. A very large structure with several big rooms, and they were able to buy it from this person at a very inexpensive price and are finishing it off. And they've had a lot of institutes there, many for women. And when the women have come, they have not only given them the Baha'i teachings, but also lessons on health, family planning, nutrition. They're very fortunate in Zimbabwe in having many pioneers who are in the health field themselves, trained doctors or optometrists or nurses. And so these Baha'is can give their services and come to these institutes and instruct the women. Interesting incident happened. On the first institute that they had for women, two women came in from one rural area, and one lady thought she would have a baby in about a month, and she had one the night of the institute. The institute is named Kristen Bank. That's the name of the area that it's in, so she named the baby Christina for was born there. Also, there are individual volunteers who are assisting in literacy programs there. So those are just a few of the projects that are going on, and those are mostly planned by the National Spiritual Assemblies at this point, because that's, of course, the strongest body in the country. And then they're going out and beginning to work with local spiritual assemblies, and the auxiliary board members are all committed to looking for the strongest local communities and trying to figure out what they can do along these same lines. I want to close by reading a couple of paragraphs from a very beautiful talk given by Ali Nakshivani, entitled Our Spiritual Growth at the World Center. He gave this to the entire center staff on the 25th of November in 1983. But there are a few paragraphs here about service, and I thought they just fitted in very nicely with what we've been talking about this afternoon and this evening about our individual commitment to service. Growth presupposes some living organism, a living entity. What is this living entity we are talking about here? It is the soul within us, a soul which would be likened to a seed. In one of his letters, Shoghi Effendi likens the soul to a seed and the effect of the Holy Spirit to the quickening of the seed. The seed comes in touch with the Holy Spirit, emanating from the manifestation of God. Therefore, it is quickened. So we acquire faith. So instead of having just a human soul, we also have the spirit of faith. But this faith is not enough. It has to be strengthened. It has to be deepened. It needs deeds, obedience. Otherwise, it will not grow. In one of his tablets, Abdu'l-Bahá says that faith should be transformed, transmuted into certitude. Faith is a stage towards certitude. We have a whole book of certitude, but certitude and faith, again, alone are not enough. We need action. We need deeds. We need sacrifice, so that these together maybe would be acceptable in his sight. I'll read you this passage from Abdu'l-Bahá. Know that nothing will benefit thee in this life save supplication and invocation unto God, service in his vineyard, and with a heart full of love to be in constant servitude unto him. Notice here that prayer, service, and servitude are mentioned together. And then he goes into an explanation of the roots of all of these words being the same root. So you see, this whole idea of service, servitude, work, and worship are interrelated, even linguistically. Spiritually, of course, they are, but linguistically, they are too. So here Abdu'l-Bahá says the same thing. He links all of these things together: worship, service, and servitude. And he says that nothing will benefit thee in this life save supplication and invocation, which is worship, and service in his vineyard, and with a heart full of love to be in constant servitude unto him. Now, we all know that he, Abdu'l-Bahá, is our exemplar. But what does he say about himself? My station is the station of servitude. A servitude which is complete, pure and real, firmly established, enduring, obvious, explicitly revealed, and the subject to no interpretation whatsoever. Thraldom to the blessed perfection is my glorious and refulgent diadem, and servitude to all, the human race, my perpetual religion. Now, when you are engaged in an act of worship or in an act of service, I can assure you, the service itself, or maybe the worship itself, in itself, is not important. But the way it is done is important. Look at this from the Bab. Worship thou God in such wise that if thy worship lead thee to the fire, no alteration in thine adoration would be produced. And so likewise, if thy recompense should be paradise. Thus and thus alone should be the worship which benefiteth the one true God. In other words, when we serve, when we pray, whatever we do, if it is for reward or punishment, fear from punishment, or a desire to receive some reward, even if it is from God, according to the Bab, that's not really the desirable thing to do, the absolute meritorious thing to do. Yes, reward and punishment, Baha'u'llah says, are necessary instruments. Pillars, he says, for the organization of the world, for the tranquility of men. They are sources of life, he says. But when it comes to rendering an act of service or an act of worship, should it be with this in mind, that I am praying so that I will go to heaven, or that I am praying so that I will not go to hell? This is what the Bab is saying. Don't do it with that motive. The motive is important. The motive should be worship for its own sake. Worship for the sake of his beauty. Worship for the sake of the love of God. I'll tell you a little story. I'll tell you a little story about Janabi Samandari. Some of us may have heard this story from him. He said that when he was young, his father sent him from Qazvin, where they were, to Rasht, where they had a branch of their office. He says, I went there and I found there was a secretary who was also an accountant, and there was also a servant in that office. He, Samandari, as the representative of the owner and the manager, was to be there too. He said that one day the servant was ill, so he went to the office and he saw that the floor had to be swept. He told the secretary, would you please sweep the floor? The secretary thought, he said, your father employed me as a secretary, as an accountant, not as a servant. Samandari said, I told him, fine, you are right. He said, the next morning very early, I went myself before the secretary had arrived, and I swept the floor. As I was sweeping the floor, I said to myself, why is it I'm happy doing this, but my secretary here is not able or not willing to do it? What is the reason? I came to the conclusion that the reason is that I consider this office to be mine, whereas he doesn't think of it as that way. Because I, when I am here, I don't want any recompense. I don't want any salary. This place belongs to me. But he works for a salary. He works for some reward. So he has a position, and he is not ready to do anything else but that. And then he said, I thought to myself, maybe the Baha'is are like that. Maybe there are those who consider the cause as their own, and they are ready to do any service. And there are those who consider the cause not quite their own, and they are there, and they have been told to do something, and they do it because they want to be in this cause, and they are getting some benefits from it, spiritually or otherwise, but they don't really consider it as their own. So you see, this is it. There are two types of thinking about relationship and the cause. There are those who serve for the sake of the cause, and there are those who serve for some form of recompense. There are those who serve because they want themselves for the cause, and there are those who serve maybe because they want the cause for themselves. Thank you.